Hello, and welcome to Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd with me, Barbara Drew. Today, I'm sitting down with Lizzie Rudd, our chair, to discuss sustainability, family, and champagne. Lizzie, welcome. This is your first time on the podcast, is that right?
Yes, it is. Thank you for having me.
You've been looking forward to this for weeks, I believe.
No, I haven't. I don't usually speak very publicly. It's not really my thing. But these are probably my three favourite subjects,
fantastic,
apart from dogs, family, champagne and sustainability.
We'll see if we can weave something about dogs in perhaps a little bit later on. I guess before we even get started, we are recording in a beautiful space today, our spirits room, one of the many, many spaces we have in this, frankly, rabbit warren of buildings at number 3 St James's Street. And Lizzie, when you came in, your eyes lit up and you honed in on a couple of the pictures on the walls. Tell us a bit about some of the things in this room.
Okay, now, there's lots of history in here, the spirits room, because of course Berry Brothers, in its second 100 years of its 325 years, was largely a whiskey business. Still, the foundation was wine, but the majority of the business was whiskey. And I look round the room here and I can see over there, there's a photograph of my parents launching a ship with a bottle of Cutty Sark, you know, being thrown against the hull. And I don't know where that was, but my parents traveled all over the world as tremendous brand ambassadors for Cutty Sark whiskey, which was such a success story for this company. It was one of the top selling scotches in the world. It was a blended Scotch whiskey, which was the fashionable type of whiskey at that time. You know, single malt really wasn't a thing then. It was all about blends. It was the number one whiskey in the US for several decades. And my father was always terribly humble about it and said, well, it was just one of those things. It just happened. We went along on the crest of a wave. I said, what, no hard work or anything like that? I think it was probably quite hard work, but they had a lot of fun as well. And I can just see over there in the corner, there's a photograph of Captain William McCoy. He was basically a smuggler in the Bahamas. And when we first launched Cutty Sark, which was innovated here at number 3 St James's Street back in 1923. It was, of course, during the Prohibition years, and yeah, it was whiskey for the US market. We had to ship it to the Bahamas, where Bill McCoy would pick it up and take it, and off it went into the US through Captain Bill McCoy, and hence the phrase, the real McCoy.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, there's a bit of history in here. And then a big photograph over there of the beautiful picture of the magnificent tall ships. 25 years, Cutty Sark sponsored the Cutty Sark tall ships races. And my father often talked about that as the thing he was most proud of, not building the best-selling Scotch in the US, but sponsoring this amazing race of around all sorts of different countries that came together every year, of groups of young people from all different nationalities who'd race on these ships and come together. And it was all about building international understanding. And the most important prize for the Cutty Sark tall ships races was called the Cutty Sark Trophy that my father used to present. And it wasn't for the winner of the race. It was for the ship who had contributed the most to international understanding during the races. So it might be, you know, they'd had to rescue somebody else or, you know, pull them off the mud or something like that. So, and he was really, really proud of that. And I think that rather represents sort of who we are as a business today, that it's not just about making money and it's so much more than that. That represents our values.
That's lovely. That's really lovely. So tell us, you're for the chair of this 325-year-old family-run business. Tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming chair. What did you do before you were our chair?
I'll tell you just a little snippet. Well, I became chair in 2017 when I took over from Simon Berry. And I had sat on the board, very non-exec, for quite a few years before that, although in my 20s, for about a decade, I did work in the business, which wasn't my intention at all. In fact, quite the opposite. During my formative years, I was actually quite rebellious. And the last thing in the world I wanted to do was join my family business. And I often say that to my youngest daughter now, who for her, it's the last thing in the world she would want to do. And I said, well, that's exactly how I felt when I was your age. And look what happened to me. Anyway, so I did work in the business for a decade. And then I actually decided to go off. My children were young and it was the right time for me to go and spend more time with them. And I actually trained in clinical nutrition and plant medicine. You might be able to imagine my journey into where that led me, into my sort of journey into sustainability and regeneration. That interest in the planet and nature and biodiversity came from very much part of my whole ethos about working with nature rather than against it.
That's really, really fascinating. And something that you've been very vocal about as your time as chair is sustainability, talking about this in terms of wines and spirits and the industry as a whole. Why is sustainability so important to you, and why do you think it should be important to the wider world?
One of the things we talk about, always have done here in the business, is integrity as one of our key values. And for me, doing the right thing for the planet, actually a big fan of, or have been for many years, of our now king and his ethos, I've always been very aligned with that. We need to look after our communities and we need to look after our planet. I think humanity, you know, we try and control everything, and actually we need to work with nature, not against it. My training in clinical nutrition very much led me down that path, and, you know, plant and herb medicine. And some of our wine producers, you know, I always see with great glee when any of the wine producers that we work with are growing medicinal herbs to make infusions to spray on their vines as medicine. I think it's the same, you know, we can do the same for people and have certain teas and wine.
That's really fascinating, isn't it? That link between, as you say, whether it's certain plants that encourage, you know, sort of health, or looking after that holistic approach is very important.
Yes, and with all of those things, it's always the medicine is the dose.
Yes. The dose makes the poison, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, looking at the sustainability side, what do you think the biggest challenge facing the wine and spirits industry is at the moment? Do you think it's that sustainability angle? Is there something in particular that is really challenging or even threatening the industry?
I think there are some very major challenges facing all businesses across the world these days, with so much uncertainty, both economic and climatic. I think for our industry, if we think ahead, and as a family business we do think, you know, long term, we think ahead, I think probably our biggest challenge will be climate change. We're already seeing it. When we talk to any of our wine producers, they all see it, they feel it, they're experiencing it, they're having to adapt to it. And wine production is one part of it, and, you know, the climate chaos that we're seeing, it's not just the warming, it's the chaos, it's the, you know so much better than me, Barbara, but late frosts and summer hail and fires, and, you know, there's so many different challenges that it must be becoming really quite stressful for some of our friends in some of the wine regions.
Indeed. And close to home as well. It's funny, I'll get customers asking me, oh, but the weather's getting warmer, it must be easier to make fantastic wine in the UK. And the reality is that yes, summers might be getting warmer, but ultimately weather patterns are becoming far more variable. And so you could almost set your watch by when you are going to pick your grapes, when you are going to be doing pruning and so on. And now you'll find that it gets very warm in February in the UK, and the vines think it's summer, and they start to produce buds, and, you know, you get bud burst. And then at the end of April, you might get frost, hail, even snow, possibly even into early May. And so then the vines are hit by this really, really hard frost. And a couple of years ago in France, they had one of the most devastating frosts they'd had for 40 years. And, you know, it hit the UK as well. And then through the growing season, it's really hot. I mean, last year it was 40 degrees in southern England. That's absolutely crazy. And then you get thunderstorms, and it's that variability and not really being able to predict it. You know, weather forecasting hasn't improved as much as perhaps we'd like it to. And all of a sudden, something, your crop that you've put a year's worth of work into, has been wiped out. So personally, I take my hat off to anyone who makes wine, because it is difficult undertaking.
Me too. In terms of, you know, moving further north now, look at English sparkling. That's potentially a wonderful opportunity for this country, and just seems to be on the cusp of really taking off and being really, really good.
Yes.
Really good quality.
The amount of work that has to go into that.
Yes, over the long term.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you talk about obviously a family business and thinking long term, not just thinking about what are we going to do for the next 5 years, but what are we going to do for the next generation. And it seems to me that the wine industry, that's very much the approach. You have to think long term. Vineyards really only produce their best fruit when they're 30 years old.
Yes.
So producers need to be thinking right now about what the weather's going to be like in 30, 40 years. What should they be planting? How should they be managing their vineyard? Which is a big ask when we can't even predict if it's going to rain tomorrow or not.
Yeah. I think it's our job as Bury Brothers and Rudd to help them with that. And I don't mean that in a patronising way, but to share information, because we have friendships with so many wine producers all over the world, and some of our producers talking about, you know, some of the things that they're doing to help mitigate climate change in the vineyard, some of the practices they can put in place, how to think about it. Also, not just in the vineyard, but things like glass. Our whole industry is grappling with glass, because that represents, you know, we've measured our carbon footprint, and that represents at least 40% of our carbon emissions.
Wow.
So how are we going to deal with that? You know, of course we can do recyclable and recycled glass, and glass is ultimately a natural product. But at the moment, it requires furnaces, which are fired up 24/7 for X number of years. And that's not good for the planet. But there's all sorts of technology and all sorts of work that we're watching very closely and actually getting involved with as well, to get to green hydrogen produced glass, so we can get to what we call net zero glass, so that we're not doing any damage to the planet. But not doing damage to the planet ultimately is not enough. So we not only need to not damage the planet, but we need to regenerate it. So we all need to be thinking about that, you know, just being sustainable in how we operate today. That's not enough. We've got to turn it around. We've got to stop the global warming. We've, you know, with the Paris Agreement has said we've got to limit global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees since pre-industrial times. You know, we're nearly there. The latest science, the even just last week, I think it was saying that we're going to hit 1.5 degrees above those levels within the next decade, several times. That was not predicted even in recent years. So it feels like it's speeding up, but not wanting to be too doom and gloom. There's so many actions that we can all be taking, every business, every individual, we can be playing our part and we can turn this around. I know we're going to need technology, but you know, backed up by technology, but how we look after the land and the people within it plays a huge part in it, which takes us on to regenerative viticulture, perhaps.
Absolutely. Gosh, she's done her preparation. Yeah, really fascinating. As you say, not just about not doing any more harm, but really, how can we improve things?
Yes.
So we started a very exciting partnership with the Regenerative Viticulture Foundation last year.
Yes, we did. Right? We did.
Tell us more.
Precisely. It's something that we would like to play our part in promoting. Many of our wine producers are practicing organic or biodynamic viticulture, not necessarily certified. That's our job as the merchant to talk about how they produce wine and how brilliant it is, regardless of whether it's certified or not. We talk a lot about regenerative viticulture, which follows very similar principles generally to biodynamic, because organic is just basically no use of artificial chemicals and fertilizers. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, Barbara.
No, it's very interesting. So yeah, organic viticulture, there are very few things that you can use, for example, in the vineyard. Mm. But as you say, one of the things that you are allowed to use in organic and viticulture is a mixture of copper and sulfur.
Mm.
And this is something that's been used in vineyards for decades, for centuries. It's very effective against some forms of mildew. And because it is quite a simple mixture, it's deemed to be suitable in organic viticulture. And the reality is that if you use too much copper, particularly, it tends to build up in the soil.
Mm, it's toxic.
And actually, yeah, it's really, really bad for earthworms, for microbes in the soil. And of course, if you're organic because you're really trying to reinvigorate your vineyard, then dumping large quantities of copper and sulfur, because that's the only recourse you've got when the mildew is really bad, a little bit counterproductive. So it's really important when discussing these types of systems, whether it's organic, whether it's biodynamic, whether it's regenerative viticulture, to sort of look at the whole picture and not just look at the label. There are wonderful organic producers out there, brilliant biodynamic producers, and there are fantastic producers who are neither, and they are still doing right by their land. So I think it's
nuanced, isn't it? Absolutely. It's not black and white.
Sadly not. It would be a lot easier if it were.
The wine world is never black and white.
No, indeed.
And that's what makes it so interesting. But yeah, I would describe very simply that regenerative agriculture or viticulture is just all about the soil. It's looking after the soil and farming the soil. It's looking after the microbes as a completely separate ecosystem. And that also fits with my ethos of human health, because it's all about the gut. When you look after the gut, then that looks after your health. It's exactly the same principle.
So fascinating. And there's so much research that's now being done on, well, both the human gut biome, but also the soil microbiome and even how that might link into the concept of terroir, the flavours that you might ultimately get in your finished wine. These microbes in the soil are incredibly important, and ultimately having a soil that is full of life and can help the vine to protect itself, whether that's against more extreme weather, whether it's against particular diseases, which sadly are also on the increase with variable weather patterns. So really sort of giving it that, almost boosting the immune system of the vineyard.
It's exactly what it's doing. Yes, I like that expression. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that if you farm regeneratively, then you're drawing carbon down from the atmosphere into the soil and keeping it into the soil, whereas intensive farming is doing the opposite. It releases carbon into the atmosphere. And that's just so simple and obvious in so many ways. And how can we help?
Yes.
As somebody in the middle.
Absolutely.
It's our job to tell our customers what people are doing, because I think customers are becoming more and more interested in this. And they want to know where their products come from, where their wine comes from, obviously where their spirits come from as well. You know, what's been the process?
Yeah.
How has it been looked after? Has it looked after the planet in its journey from seed to palate?
Exactly. It's the same with any, you know, agricultural product. I think we're seeing more and more people want to know where their vegetables have come from, how they were grown, you know, their meat, sort of how the animals were treated. It's really important, and wine shouldn't be any different. You should want to know about it and understand it.
The implications of that as well for building a cellar. You know, if you're thinking ahead and laying down wine now for sort of 20 years' time, you know, what will people be thinking when they, in 20 years' time, when they come to drink wine? Will they look back and go, oh my God, how was that produced? And was it done well?
Yeah.
Or will they go, oh, I feel a bit uncomfortable drinking that because of how it was produced?
Very interesting, isn't it? The bottle that you put on the table at your dinner party and your guests look at you and go, oh. Okay. It's attitudes change, and I do think this is becoming more and more important.
Mm, definitely.
Speaking of that, shall we have a little look at the bottle that you've brought along for us today? Because I think this embodies so many of these ideas. So I asked you to choose a single bottle, which I know you did have difficulty doing it, but you finally narrowed down.
Very difficult to choose one wine.
Tell us a little bit about what you've brought for us to taste.
Or indeed one spirit.
Indeed, yes.
So we have here a bottle of Leclerc Brion Champagne, which is one of my absolute favourites. This is the Reserve Brut. We sell it for £50 a bottle, I think, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Leclerc Brion is the most wonderful champagne house. They are organic and biodynamic, and they are trailblazers. They've been organic since the 1960s, I believe, yeah, and biodynamic since the 1980s.
Which, just to give some context, champagne as a region, it makes beautiful wine, food is exquisite, but the weather does leave something to be desired. And particularly, you know, in the 80s, if you're saying, I'm going to grow my grapes with no artificial pesticides, no fungicides, and just sort of do everything as naturally as possible, that was a real risk. Mm. You know, you can do that in the warm climates of the Barossa Valley, but in Champagne, it's really difficult. So that shows how important this was to them, that they took that risk and said, We don't care what the cost is, you know, this is the right way of doing things.
Major challenge. But it's their philosophy is what I just love, because it's about taking out less than you put in and trying not to control nature, but listen to it instead. Love that. They place nature in the middle of everything they do, which of course is what we all need to be doing now. And their winemaker, Hervé Gestam, who is a remarkable man, it's his ethos and his philosophy, which is wonderful. One of the things he said was that there are 50,000 molecules in champagne, and mankind has only learnt about 5,000 of them. Mm. So how can we say we know champagne? And we can say that about so many other things, where we think we have all the answers for so many things, and we really don't, and we need to look to nature for the answers. He very much believes that, you know, wine is very much a living thing, and that when you taste some of the wine that he has made, you really get to understand that.
Yeah. Shall we taste it?
Shall we?
Shall we?
Yes, let's. And one of the wines that they produce is the Abyss.
Yes.
Which is laid down 60 metres under the sea, which to begin with, you'd think, well, maybe that's a bit of a gimmick, but actually it isn't. It's because they really believe in what they're doing.
I mean, one of the reasons for aging this, the Abyss cuvée under the sea, you know, the pressure in a bottle of wine is quite high. I say this as I'm trying to elegantly open this bottle of champagne, and the cork is threatening to fly out and cause serious damage to this rather old building. You know, there's a huge amount of pressure in a bottle of wine, and actually, if you age...
That's a good sound.
If you age your champagne under the sea, you can take it down to the level where the pressure outside the bottle is equivalent to the pressure inside the bottle.
Yes, so it's perfect equilibrium. And complete darkness, no oxygen, constant temperature, and he says, perhaps most importantly, an environment that's totally undisturbed by humankind, which is rather wonderful, isn't it? We're not drinking Abyss, we're drinking Reserve. And Hervé Gestin actually is also the consultant winemaker for Hambledon English Sparkling, who make our Berry Zone Selection English Sparkling wine, which is delicious.
That's really interesting. Why, given the wealth of beautiful vineyards available to him in Champagne, might he be turning his attention to England?
I wonder. Why do you think, Barbara? Because that's it's up and coming and it's the future. He can see the potential there.
That's really interesting.
And Hambledon is a special place as well.
Yeah, sharing of expertise. And it's something we're seeing more of in the English wine industry, both for sparkling and for still wine, is, you know, more winemakers, whether it's from France or further afield, lending their expertise, perhaps setting up joint ventures to bring their ideas to the UK, which is quite heartwarming.
It's super.
So I've poured the champagne out. We're using actually our very own champagne flutes, which were designed by Simon Berry, I believe, along with some of our masters of wine. And the flute, very important not to have a flute that's too narrow. You want to have quite a lot of space for your champagne to roam around so that the flavours and aromas can really make an impression. I mean, the first thing that strikes me is this beautiful golden colour. The champagne has been aged for quite a while. So it's a non-vintage champagne. That means it's a blend of different years, but the majority year in the wine is 2015. So we're looking at a wine that's around about 8 years old, and it's spent about 4.5 of those years in bottle on its yeast cells, developing all sorts of wonderful toasty, creamy and pastry flavours. It's a little bit like going into the very best bakery, one that isn't too heavy on the bread, but it's got a really good line of cakes. There's also lots of wonderful citrus fruit here as well. And one of the joys about Hervé's wines is that there's a real freshness and a real vitality, even when they are quite mature, when they've been aged for a long time, much longer than this, and you get this lovely fresh character coming through. Really mouth-watering acidity, but very well balanced. Hervé doesn't use very much sugar for the final dosage. That's the final little drop of sugar added at the very end of the process, just before the final cork goes in. This one's only about 4 grams, which is very, very low by champagne standards, just enough to offset all of those wonderful citrus flavours and then the wonderful sort of bready character. It's really...
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Really quite delicious.
Lovely. It's such a... That vitality really picks you up, doesn't it?
It does. One of the things that I love about champagne is, you know, as a region, it has as much diversity as any other wine region in the world. There are champagnes which are quite light in terms of flavour. You've got really sort of full-bodied, bold champagnes. And you've got champagnes like this, which have this wonderful freshness and personality, but are still, you know, very, very elegant. It's not a shouty champagne.
No, it's not, is it? It's quite subtle.
Yeah.
Just really incredibly delicious.
Beautiful. Incredibly beautiful.
Do you have a favourite champagne of the moment?
Right now, this glass that is in front of me is tasting utterly good. Delicious.
Cheers.
Gosh, this is delicious. Lizzie, you've spoken about sustainability and the environment and how important it is for the industry to think about this. But I always think that there are three pillars of sustainability, really. So as well as the environment, we need to look at economic sustainability and social sustainability. So looking at the social sustainability angle, making sure that we have a trade that is as diverse as it could be, what do you think still needs to be done to improve diversity and equality in the wine trade?
Well, I think it's changing very rapidly, actually. At Barry Brothers and Rudd here, we're actually majority female-led in the business, aren't we? And
which is still something of a rarity.
It's very unusual, yes. Yeah. We do quite enjoy surprising people when they come into this little corner of St. James's, which is the heart of, you know, what was traditionally a very male part of London, and the wine trade, which was traditionally a very male industry. And people come in here and we say, yes, well, Berry Brothers was started by a woman back in 1698, surprise one. And then my grandmother, she was chair for 16 years after the World War II.
Incredible.
And that was incredibly unusual then. And I think it was probably more because there wasn't anyone else in her generation to do it. But I know she did a very good job. I have heard from people who knew, who are still here. And now we have a lot of women in the business. And goodness me, we do get things done very quickly. Gosh, we're moving faster than I think we've probably ever moved before, which is very exciting. It's wonderful. Within the wider trade, I would hope, I think we do our bit here as much as we can to promote women in business by role modelling as much as we can and by talking about it and by encouraging younger women wherever we can. And yes, the wine world is certainly changing quite quickly. There are a lot of female wine producers now moving down, you know, being passed down to the next generation of women rather than men.
Yeah, that's something that's really lovely to see, actually, is I've noticed there are sort of two trends in terms of grape growing and winemaking. One is the, let's say, fairly traditional wine producing regions, maybe some of the classic regions like Burgundy. We do see a lot of daughters taking over those family businesses, which is really, really fantastic. But also newer producers setting up who are women. Yeah. So I think certainly on the production side, huge progress has been made, which is really exciting. Yes.
We'd like to do more on the customer side. We'd love to have more female wine collecting customers. It's something that's really enjoyable. I mean, I love collecting wine. I know I've grown up with it, but I know the women that I know that do collect wine and build cellars with us really, really enjoy it. It only comes with one warning from me, which is be careful, it's very addictive.
We asked our Instagram followers for questions for you, Lizzie, and I don't want to jump ahead too much. We'll cover a few of them towards the end of the episode. But one of the questions that came in was, how do we encourage more women to get involved in the world of wine? Is there more we can do? How do we get the message out there that this is a welcoming community, whether you're working, whether you're collecting, whether you're just dipping your toe in the water of tasting wine?
I think we need to go out to more women and be a little more proactive, you know, and say, come on, this is really fun. Come and have a go. And I'm having dinner this evening with a group of our existing female customers to ask them exactly that. And see what they think about, you know, why do they collect wine with us? And what more can we do to encourage more women to come and collect wine with us? And I think sometimes it's partly just getting people through the door and to come and have a tasting or do a short course about wine and enjoy it. I think often women think it's a man's domain, and it absolutely isn't, I promise you.
I can only concur.
Exactly. You're a master of wine. Yeah. Far more qualified than I am.
Yeah, it would be, from my perspective, I see more and more women coming to tastings and dinners that I host, really wanting to learn about some of these wonderful producers, learn about the wines, learn about spirits as well. We are a wine and spirits merchant, and wanting to sort of start building their collections of wines. You know, I know from my own experience, when I first applied for a job here, there was something a little nerve-wracking about walking through that creaky shop door and into the front of the shop.
Yes. There's a lot of history here from
can't detract from
centuries
that.
Of maledom.
Yeah.
But it's
not
it's,
about
it's,
sort of no, changing the history no, or completely rewriting it, no. But just how do we get the message out there that some of the stereotypes are actually nonsense.
Exactly. I think we just keep shining a light on it and keep talking about it.
And one of the things we've not touched on too much, and we mentioned it briefly at the start with the wonderful collection of pictures in this room, and this is of course a family business, and you are not the only family member within this business. In fact, there's quite a few different family members spread out across all sorts of different departments. Does working with family make things easier or trickier in business?
Do I have to be honest? Actually, I can be totally honest. Sometimes it depends, but we here are incredibly lucky. We are two families and we get on incredibly well. And I think being two families, being the Berry family and the Rudd family, actually helps because we sort of dilute each other. And if there are any potential conflicts or difficult conversations, we could invite someone from the other family to come in, which was exactly how my family joined the business. Back in 1920, my grandfather joined because, well, so I'm told the main reason, he was a wine expert as well, but he joined because they needed the two Berry cousins at the time, they were part business partners, really didn't get on. And so they needed somebody else to come and join them. That's how the Rudd family came about into Berry Brothers and became Berry Brothers and Rudd. And I hopefully we've been doing that ever since. Now the Berries get on very well and so do the Rudds. We all get on incredibly well together. And so long may it last.
A question I'm sure you get asked an awful lot. Have you ever considered your legacy at Berry Brothers and Rudd and what you'd like it to be, knowing that you hold the reins for a short time, given the overall big picture, and then you pass them on to the next generation?
Absolutely. Of course, I've thought about that. When I first took on the mantle, I remember feeling this huge sense of responsibility and fear and dread. I mean, oh my goodness. And then as I got into it and got used to it, that's now turned into a real sense of privilege and honour to have had the opportunity to have this role. I've always said that I really want Berry Brothers and Rudd to be the best and most trusted fine wine and spirit merchant in the world. But I also want it to be the best merchant for the world. And the more we can do that, do the right thing, and that's what we're working towards. But I would also like to venture into new areas, new but related. So within drinks.
Tell me more.
Well, I can't really say much yet, but watch this space. We had just made a small investment into the Cotswolds Whiskey Distillery.
We have.
English whiskey, which is fantastic whiskey. And there are a few other things that we'd quite like to do to just start to expand into new areas. We have to keep changing. We have to change, as every business has to keep changing, even just to stand still in order to stay the same. The only thing that stays the same is how we do things. But what we do, it will change, always has done, over 300 years. We're a completely different business now, much bigger as well, but completely different from how we were last century, last decade even. We're evolving quickly all the time.
Don't imagine the widow born would have been thinking of her store having an outpost in Hong Kong and Tokyo, Singapore.
Absolutely. Where next?
Before we sat down to record with you, Lizzie, we went out to our Instagram followers and asked them whether they had any questions for you. And I was delighted by the questions that came back.
Uh-oh.
We won't have time to answer all of them, sadly. The first question that really caught my eye, and this goes back actually to what you were saying right at the start about ships and the Cuttysark tall ships race. Is there a carbon efficient way to transport wine around the globe? Do you see us going back to sending wine around the world in ships?
That is a great question. We have considered it. We have considered, should we be shipping from Bordeaux to the UK by sailing ship again? And I know that there is technology afoot right now, a different type of sailing ship. So not your traditional sailing ship, but ship that's powered by a type of sails. And I think as soon as that comes on board, or whether it's, you know, electric ships or hydrogen powered ships, yeah, we'll be right in there.
Fantastic. Which part of the business do you see becoming even more important in the future?
Spirits. Spirits again. I think we've been very, and quite rightly so, we've been very focused on wine over the last, well, since we sold the Cuttysark brand in 2010. So over the last 13 years, we've been very focused on making the most of our wonderful wine business. But there's a huge opportunity for us to do more in spirits and focus on collecting spirits. And, you know, a lot of our customers who collect wine are whiskey collectors or other spirit collectors. We'd like to do more in that area. And we're just delving into that now. So there's going to be a lot happening in spirits. And we'd like to major on all sorts of different whiskies from all around the world. So not just Scotch or American or Irish, the ones that, or Japanese that everyone knows about. But there are all sorts of distilleries popping up, producing amazing whiskey all over the world. We're going to specialise in the best whiskey from around the world.
Do you think that this is a good solution to climate change? If we can't quite get the wines that we need, if wine regions are struggling with the climate, we can focus on spirits where perhaps the weather is slightly less important.
I think it's an interesting point, and it is certainly one way of mitigating the risk in the wine world. But we'd never walk away from wine totally, because We couldn't do that. We're on the journey with all our wine producers, and we will stick with them and we'll help them as much as we possibly can. And obviously we have to be careful if we're shipping spirits or wine from all around the world. But as the technology comes, I hope we'll be able to transport in a net zero carbon way. And that's what we're working towards.
You mentioned glass a little earlier as well, and you said it accounts for something like 40% of the carbon footprint of a bottle of wine, which is astonishing and terrifying. You know, we focus a lot on what happens in the vineyard, but maybe not so much on the glamorous side of bottling and logistics. Would Berry Brothers and Rudd ever sell wine in a can or a different format to get around the difficulties of the glass bottle?
I would like to know if any of our customers listen to this. Would you tell us if you think we should be selling good ordinary claret in a smart...
good ordinary can.
Box. No, I was thinking box probably rather than can. But you can get really lovely boxes of wine. So maybe we could
sell
it side by side and see how that goes. Although they do, I think, usually have a plastic liner.
They do.
And plastic is, you know, not great. Anyway, that's a byproduct of fossil fuels. It's fine as long as it can be recycled. But in the end, I think the solution will be glass, but net zero glass and lighter.
Yeah, there are definitely some bottles which are unnecessarily heavy. And this beautiful Le Clerc Brion is understandably moderately heavy. Champagne bottles, sparkling wine bottles need to be, simply because of the pressure of the wine inside. But if it's a still wine, there's no reason why the bottle needs to be 900 grams a kilo. That is really unnecessary.
In the meantime, we need to get to bottles being recycled, not just recyclable, because that's still new glass. Mm. We need bottles to be recycled, and then they can be recycled over and over again.
That is an interesting point. I mean, just because a material can be recycled doesn't mean that it is. One more question before you head off. What is the most memorable wine you ever drank?
There are quite a few, but there is one. And actually I had two most memorable wines, and they both come from the same chateau, over a very different time period. But the one I remember the most was at my father's 60th birthday dinner here. And I was only invited because somebody else dropped out at the last minute. So I was a sort of last minute, oh, do you want to come? I said, yes, okay, that would be lovely. And I didn't really appreciate what we were drinking necessarily at the time because I was quite young then. We had an 1868 Chateau Lafite. When it came out, I thought, oh, this is really, really special. I saw it and thought, gosh, I know this is really, really special. And it tasted incredible. And there was lots left over. I was with my parents the next evening and we drank the leftovers of 1868 Chateau Lafite with sausages and mash. And I think it was even better the next day.
Absolutely brilliant.
And that really was. And I will always remember that. It was a special occasion and marked with a very special wine that I think his father had probably bought many, many years ago, and he'd had it sat in his cellars. Actually, he died a couple of years ago, but we still have two or three bottles left somewhere, which I thought about bringing one of those today, but I didn't think I'd be very popular with my brothers if I cracked open a bottle of... You and I would have a nice time.
I'll forgive you, Lizzie. It's okay. Thank you so, so much. It has been absolutely wonderful speaking with you, and some really fantastic insights and very inspiring. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd. If you'd like to learn more about Le Clerc Brion, visit bbr.com/podcast. Or if you're interested in starting your own fine wine collection with Berry Brothers and Rudd, all the information you need can be found on bbr.com/collecting. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you again for listening. I'm off to track down some 1868 Lafite. Cheers!